Okay, I think we should start up. Let me welcome you to the fourth lecture in the inaugural lecture series for the LSE Cold War Study Center. We are very fortunate tonight to have with us Professor Fred Halliday from the International Relations Department here at LSE. Of course, Fred doesn't really need an introduction when he's speaking in the old theater at LSE. So what I decided to do was to make this a reasonably personal introduction, in the sense that, as I've already told Fred, he said it is in part responsible for why I ended up at LSE in the first place. I had an interest in the Cold War with regard to the Third World, especially. And reading Fred's books, his book on South Yemen that came out of the PhD that he did here at LSE, and his book with Maxine Molyneux on the Ethiopian Revolution, were among the things that inspired me to start getting into the events of the Cold War in the Third World, which then about 20 years later ended in a book that I'm just trying to finish up now, besides running the center and doing other things. So in a very personal way, for good or for bad, Fred is at least partially responsible for me choosing the career path, which I've done, and then ending up as a result of that at LSE. The topic for Professor Halliday's talk today is Rethinking the Origins of September 11th, the End of History and the Collapse of the Soviet Empire. Now, Fred informed me beforehand that he's not very keen on the term the Soviet Empire. Neither am I. And whatever we want to call it, the main issue, I think, for today's lecture is that it's no longer here. So, Fred, please.
Thank you very much, Arnie. You sometimes get blamed for things you're not responsible for, and you sometimes get thanked for things that you can claim no credit for, and I think this is certainly a case of it. I'd like to thank the Cold War Center very much and the IR department for inviting me here to speak. This is a very important academic initiative being taken at a time when there are still people alive, many people alive, who not just remember the Cold War, as I do and many people in this room do, but were also participants in it and decision makers in great or small ways, including very important category of translators, who I believe are a key source of many of the more intricate and undocumented diplomatic initiatives of modern times. But it's also a time, I think, when we can look at it with perspective. I'm exaggerating a bit, but I have a sense that in the last week we have seen the end of three interregnums, three periods of intermission. One is clearly that the U.S. president has acquired a clear democratic mandate, which he did not get in 2000. He has a 3 million vote plurality. He has a majority in Congress. And therefore, whatever doubts, whatever interregnum about the character of the United States now, about its domestic politics, about the role of religion, about the shift to the right, I think that question has been settled. The America we see after November the 2nd is the America we have and will probably have for quite some time. The second interregnum, I think, is the interregnum since September the 11th. I think it was unclear after September the 11th which way the world would go, and in particular which way the United States would go, given that the United States is the country most affected by that particular attack. There were glimmers of what, for want of a better word, we can call multilateralism after September the 11th. The president has said he will reach out here and there. There is talk of reconciliation with Europe. But I think a quite different path has eventuated and will eventuate. The president is consistent in these matters. His interpretation of the what's called GWAT, the Global War on Terrorism, is a military one. It is one in which the United States is unilateral when it wants to be and multilateral when it doesn't matter very much. And this is the pattern we are going to see for quite some time. On the other hand, I think it would be an enormous mistake to underestimate the struggling brother, Osama bin Laden. I have been writing an article called Osama bin Clausewitz because I think that the most important lesson to recall about terrorism, not just his terrorism, but the terrorism of others, including organizations I know quite well by dint of my childhood, namely the IRA, is that, to coin a phrase, terrorism is the continuation of politics by other means. And the people in charge of terrorist campaigns are not fanatics. They are not crazy. I have met terrorists and I've interviewed them. And they talk like long-term investors. They're calm. They're clear. They know what they're going for. They're not shouting and screaming and waving their arms. It may be that, as with markets, the guys on the floor are waving their arms and jumping about. But the key people sitting in the offices are not of this character. And I can say this having looked more than one of them in the eye. I spent 2 days with Hezbollah in Lebanon recently and was, to put it mildly, rather educated by what I learnt. I think it would be a great mistake to underestimate their long-term commitment and a great mistake to underestimate the popularity which they enjoy, not just in the Muslim world, but elsewhere. We are in this one for the long haul. And by the long haul, I mean 10, 20, 30 years. We should recognize this fact. I think the third interregnum we've come to the end of, which pertains to the subject of this center, is the interregnum following the end of the Berlin Wall 15 years ago yesterday, or the day before yesterday, I think, 9th of November 1989, an event I remember very well. I think it is possible now to see what the geography of the post-communist world is. And the paradox is that Russia, which was the main protagonist in the Cold War, is now groveling to the West. Putin is being polite about the West to get a green light for his authoritarian project, whereas the most important country in the world, which was communist, remains communist, which is China, not in ideology, but in political control by the party elite. And China has emerged in the last 4 years as the major rising economic power in the world. And to me, the significance of this is that the end of communism was a European affair, but not an Asian affair, and has had this quite unexpected outcome, which is the emergence of China as a very astute economic and strategic power, ending, in a way, the process which began 500 years ago with Christopher Columbus's sailing to America, by which the Atlantic or the mid-Atlantic was the center of the world. The mid-Atlantic has ceased to be the center of the world in the last 2 or 3 years. It is the Pacific is the center of the world now. And this was evident in the dog that did not bark in the US elections. You remember 4 years ago, Bush said that China was not a partner but a rival. Now there was no such talk. The United States has virtually a hotline relationship with the leadership in Beijing. U.S.-Chinese trade and Chinese, among other things, purchase of U.S. Treasury bonds are a major feature of the world economy. And China is gradually, slowly, very deliberately building its strategic and economic power in East Asia. And this, I think, is the real verdict of the fall of the Berlin Wall. Not just that communism collapsed in Europe, but that the much more powerful and successful communist state of Asia has survived in a transformed way. We can ask as social scientists, and I think it is one of the most interesting questions for all of us to ask, whatever our particular discipline is, can this Chinese experiment continue? Every lesson, if there are lessons of history, sociological, legal, psychological, political, tells us this thing cannot go on. At some point, economic change combined with political paralysis will lead to an explosion. But maybe it won't. I think we have emancipated ourselves, I hope, from simple historical, as it were, railway track views of how things develop. And so we are left 15 years on with this very fascinating question about the balance of power in the world, about the fate of communism, where has produced this very successful transition in China, and indeed about whether you can have profound economic and social change, including mass poverty in the countryside, mass unemployment, rising corruption, combined with economic growth. And I am perhaps too battered by the surprises of world history over my adult life to say that I'm sure the Chinese experiment will fail. I just don't know. And this brings me to what is, I think, the central question for me tonight, which is this, that one of the joys, many joys of teaching at LSE is if you want to visit a country almost anywhere in the world for the price of a few lectures on globalization or nationalism or whatever, balance of power, you can do it. And a few years ago, as part of my course on revolutions, I decided I didn't want to go to China. So sure enough, a couple of phone calls to a former PhD student, and I got myself 2 weeks lecturing at People's University. They don't call it People's University anymore now. They call it something else, but they used to call it Renmin University in Beijing. And it was absolutely fascinating. I gave the standard LSE lecture on the theories of nationalism. And at the end, I got a response, which I'd also got in two other putatively historic capitals, namely Cairo and Tel Aviv. And the response was, these theories of nationalism are all very interesting, Professor Halliday, but we don't need them. We've been a nation for 3,000 years. You people in Europe may need all this stuff about modernity, but we don't need Anthony Smith and Gellner and these Anderson. We don't need this stuff because we've been a nation for thousands of years. I got the same response in Cairo, the same in Tel Aviv, and the same in Beijing. I just say that by the by. But the experience I want to relate was one day I decided I'd go down to Tiananmen Square. You go down there, and for the price of about a pound, I think 10 yuan, which I think was about a pound in those days, you can go up on the podium and stand on the exact spot, very spot, where Mao Zedong, in October 1949, proclaimed to the world that China had stood up. This is the famous speech he made after the revolution. He said, China has stood up. Very interestingly, and Arnie can correct me on this, I think this is the only time he ever spoke in public, or he very rarely spoke in public, because he had a provincial accent, which in China was regarded as a bit comic, and also dictators actually don't always speak in public. Milosevic is an example of somebody hardly ever spoke in public, as compared to Comandante Fidel and Gaddafi and others who go the other way. And Ataturk, who indeed talked for 2 weeks non-stop on a basis of an eight-hour day, the famous Buyuk Nutuk, and you can listen to it on a little scratchy recording if you go to his house, the parliament in Ankara. And I felt very moved. I thought, this is a historic spot. I didn't foresee what we now know, that China really had stood up. But then I looked at the young Chinese down there selling ties and chatting, and I thought, what do they care about this? The guy's been dead 20 years. The event which I'm thinking about, which I remember because I've studied it, and is nearly 50 years old. It's a bit like asking people of my generation about Stanley Baldwin or Calvin Coolidge or the Stavisky Affair. I mean, these are things long ago. What does this history mean? And what, more generally, does the Cold War mean for people of a younger generation? And why should we be interested in it? Now, it seems to me that there are four reasons why the Cold War matters and why the study of it should be part of the agenda, as it is, of documentation, of oral history, of analysis, of discussion with participants in a university of this kind. The first was, this was a major historical event in the history of the 20th century. It lasted basically 40 years from the late, I mean, you can dispute when did the Cold War started, but for sure it had started by the time Mao Zedong got up on the podium in Tiananmen Square, and there had already been the Berlin crisis and others before that. I think you can say it started in 1947, and you can say it either ended in 89 with the fall of the Berlin Wall or in 91 with the collapse of the Soviet Union. But we're talking the thick end of 40 years. It was, in broad terms, the third chapter of the European and, to a large extent, world civil war that had begun in 1914. The first chapter was World War I. Second chapter was World War II, and the third chapter was the Cold War. And it was a continuation of that. And in the end, the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991 marked the end of the consequences of World War I. It marked the end of the creation of the Soviet Union out of that collapse of the Tsarist Empire. In Europe, it cost the lives of very few people, except in the Greek Civil War and in the repressions which followed. But in the world as a whole, it's estimated to have cost between 20 and 25 million dead. If you think of the wars of Vietnam, of Korea, of Southern Africa, of Central America, of Algeria, where a million people died at the hands of the French, and elsewhere. And the effects of it remain enormous. And this is the other major theme I want to make tonight, that we have gone into denial about the Cold War. We don't talk about it. There are no monuments to the Cold War in London compared to every rinky-dink colonial expedition of the 19th century that you can see about. The discussion of the Cold War is skewed by the belief that one side won and the other didn't. Well, one side did win, and I insist that one side won. There's no point in saying, well, in the USG, you know, the schools are in a mess and so on. The US won the Cold War. The West won the Cold War, whether you like it or not. But by winning, the arguments were made, we don't need to think about it. Just as one congressman said about area studies, well, we've beaten the guys, why do we need to study them? You haven't quite beaten them is one problem. But secondly, I think there are many unresolved issues from the Cold War, which unless we confront, we will go on repeating the mistakes of the past. And in this context, and with due modesty, in the spirit of one of my great LSE heroes, Ernest Gellner, I want to offer a slightly frivolous and colloquial grand theory. I mean, you know, if you want to sell a book, you've got to have a grand theory, and best of all, make people slightly nervous, like becoming this and the imminent that and so on. It used to be the Japanese threat, the European threat, the this. So we've had the end of history, we've had the clash of civilizations, and so on and so forth, the new Middle Ages. I want to offer you, in all sincerity, the three dustbins theory. This is my take on the contemporary world. But basically, from the Cold War, we've inherited three heaps of garbage, three dustbins, which continue to affect and form the nature of the contemporary world. There is the Soviet dustbin, there is the American Western dustbin, and there is the dustbin of the anti-globalization protest movements. And all three, and I repeat, all three, have brought from the Cold War a set of policies and assumptions and concepts which are bedeviling the contemporary world and bedeviling the resolution of the problems we face. One obvious example of this, which is mentioned in the title of this lecture, which I'll come back to, is you cannot understand bin Laden's organization if you do not see its origins in the Cold War, and in particular in the war in Afghanistan in the 1980s, when the West armed and trained large numbers of Muslim fundamentalists to fight the Soviet forces. I was in Afghanistan during that war. I went on a mission on behalf of the World Council of Churches, but indirectly on behalf of the UN in 1980, to propose and work out a plan for a diplomatic solution of the Afghan war and diplomatic withdrawal of the Soviet forces, which in the end was achieved in April 1988. And I have to say that I was one of a few people, and Jonathan Steele of The Guardian is with us, he was one of the other people, I think we're about 10 of us in the whole of the West, other than Stalinists, who were not convinced of the virtue of supporting the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. I call myself a premature anti-terrorist. I was against bin Laden and his people from the beginning. And I was of the belief, which I hold to, that it was advisable to have a diplomatic solution and that a reforming, if autocratic, communist government in Afghanistan was preferable in world terms to the coming of the fundamentalists to power. And nothing that I've seen since has convinced me that I was wrong. But this was certainly a minority view. And yet I think that Afghanistan was the cauldron in which the poisons and the violence that bedeviled the world were cooked in the 1980s. And it was to the 21st century, to the problems we face, what the Spanish Civil War of the 30s was to Europe of the mid-20th century. It was in that cauldron, just as in the Spanish Civil War, you had fascist intervention by the Germans and the Italians. You had the pious non-intervention of the West, which enabled the Germans and the Italians to wreak their havoc, and on the other side, to enable Stalin to wreak his havoc. It was that which led to the defeat of the Spanish Republic. I'm living at the moment in Barcelona, which is a city which was visited in no uncertain terms by Franco's forces in early 1939, and by Stalin's KGB before that. And I think the failure to understand what was happening in Afghanistan in the 80s, just as the failure to understand what was happening in Spain in the 30s, is at the root of much of the problems that we face today. And this is one example of others I will give of the way in which I think that the past, the Cold War past, is in a way that is largely denied determining the present, because in 99% of the studies and speeches you read about bin Laden, they talk about the Arab mind and the Quran this and underdevelopment or poverty. But what about politics and what about the Cold War? Bin Laden is the illegitimate child of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. That is the reality behind it, whether they like it or not. And he knew it very well. He used to come to London. I know he came to London, although it's not public knowledge, and he was well entertained in certain Arab embassies. This was not the only factor behind Al-Qaeda, which I'll come back to, but is an important context for understanding it. The third reason why the Cold War is important, and I speak here in the language of the International Relations Department, it raises a lot of very interesting theoretical issues. Arnie may correct me, and Mick Cox may correct me, but I think that there was a large literature at the time on the history of the Cold War, particularly on the origins of the Cold War, or on Soviet foreign policy, or on bits of the third world, like the Cuban Missile Crisis of 62 or the Vietnam War. But very little attention was given to the broader implications for social science of the Cold War. For example, the role of ideology. It was common at the time to say everybody was cynical, nobody believed everything. I want to tell you, people didn't believe. Harry Truman, Ronald Reagan, and Margaret Thatcher believed in a certain model of the West, and socially, economically, and strategically. And Brezhnev and Stalin believed, as Castro still believes, in an alternative model. This was not all realpolitik. It was an intersection of realpolitik with ideology. But you cannot write the history of the 20th century, you cannot write the history of nationalism in the Third World, and you cannot write the history of the Cold War if you think that ideas don't matter in international politics or international issues. They do. And now come lately historians are saying, my gosh, you know, Stalin actually believed, well, Stalin did believe these things. He was brutal, he was cruel, but he also had a vision. So did Mao Zedong. And that vision drove what they did. Not only that, but millions of people fought and died to try and make this a reality. You may say it was mistaken, but they believed in it. Now people in Eastern Europe say no one believed in communism. People did believe. Czechoslovakia, in East Germany, in Poland, many people, not the majority, but they believed in building socialism. They believed in something. And they also believed that the world was going in their direction, which, of course, most certainly was not. I think another theoretical question which is raised, and a very difficult one, is what was communism? Communism was a utopia which failed, and in my view was bound to fail. Its failure was not contingent. It was not because Khrushchev failed to survive, or because Gorbachev pulled the plug, or because Stalin used the Kirov assassination to pursue his purges. It was doomed from the beginning. And it was a fundamentally illusory view of the world in terms of the possibility of creating the alternative which it propounded. But that's not enough, because why did people believe in it? What was it that drove people to believe in communism? And the answer, in my view, has to be that communism grew and spread because people rejected. They revolted against the world that they saw. They revolted against colonialism. They revolted against the great slump and the failure of capitalism in the 30s. They revolted against fascism. They revolted against the inequalities of the society they lived in. In other words, communism was a utopian, distorted, and destructive product, but of an extremely unequal and violent system, which people saw and rejected. It was a product of the contradictions of modernity. And those contradictions have not gone away. So although we do not have communism, we do have illusions. And the deeper sources of communism, which were not just because a few intellectuals got off the leash and propounded idiotic ideas, those contradictions remain. And I think that those theoretical issues are an appropriate part of the study of the Cold War. If we look at the Cold War itself, and I've said basically I think this was an event of great historic importance in the 20th century. It's something from which we have not emancipated ourselves, and also one that raises important theoretical developments and theoretical questions. But it was also part of the lived experience of many people in this room. I worked on a number of Third World revolutions. I visited quite a number of countries in the Third World. But I also visited two very fascinating countries about which I learned a great deal, which were the Soviet Union and the United States. And a very interesting experience was, as a young researcher with the liberal think tank in Washington, the Institute for Policy Studies, with a starting salary of $3,000 a year, but a pretty limitless travel budget, and coming from this city where government is closed and the press is of a deeply Philistine nature, I was amazed at the courtesy and help I received in both Moscow and Washington, I have to say. Of course, Washington was more open than Moscow, but once you got to know people in the institutes and in the press, they'd take you out to lunch, they'd tell you things, you'd discover their parents had been killed by Stalin, you'd discover that they spoke seven languages, you'd discover that they were pretty well informed about the state of the world. And you also discover they're very worried about what the Americans were up to with Cruz and Pershing missiles, for example. And in Washington, in my late 20s, coming from a way-out think tank, I was received for one hour by the desk officer of Afghanistan, the desk officer of Cuba, the desk officer of Yemen. They were happy to talk to me because I'd actually been there, which they hadn't. And they told me, they didn't tell me everything, but they told me a lot, and I got a lot from it. And I am always very grateful to those people in the State Department and people in the institutes in Moscow who told me as much as I did. You also learned things about the culture of countries. I remember one Russian saying to me, you know, British scholar, he said to me, you're going to these third world countries, he said, you better be careful, they're very dangerous, opasni elementi, these are dangerous elements. So I said, who do you mean? He said, slushite. He said, listen, there are three very dangerous peoples in this world. First of all, Palestinians. Patom Bulgarians, he said, they're number two. And most dangerous of all, Cubans, he said, keep away from these people. But he also, in this Russian week, gave me advice. He said, you are very shabbily present. You're presenting yourself very shabbily as a nauchnik, as an investigator. He said, the two things, your watch and your briefcase. Very Russians like this word, shabby. Very shabby, he used to say. You're very shabby. But in the Russian, next time I saw him, he gave me a briefcase. And in the U.S., we were part of a very zany alternative group. Mary Calder was part of this group, Anthony Barnett from Open Democracy, Gabriel Kolko, Al Perovitz, and people. There was a kind of very feisty resistance to the dominant views of the time, born out of people who had lived through two very powerful formative experiences in the Cold War. One was the civil rights movement of the early 60s, and the other was the movement against the Vietnam War. And I particularly like the story of one of our associates was a well-known American leftist and filmmaker called Paul Jacobs. And he went to Cuba and stayed in the former Hilton Hotel, which became known as the Havana Libre, the Free Havana. And when he came back to the States, he was at a party in Hollywood in the way that U.S. leftists do. And Conrad Hilton showed up. So he said, Mr. Hilton, very nice to meet you. You know, I just stayed in one of your hotels. It was fantastic. The service was great. So Hilton said, oh, which one? And Paul said, the Havana, you know, the in Havana. So Hilton went crazy. And he said, before I die, that hotel will have my name again. And Paul said, very nice to meet you, Mr. Libre. After the Cold War, I was able to go to Washington and to Moscow and interview participants. I went to the U.S. in the mid-90s, interviewed Kennan, George Kennan, who'd been in the same office since he retired, overlooking the battlefield of Princeton. Been in the same office since 1951, and I think he was one of the smartest and wisest of all the commentators. And interestingly, the document that he sent, which in a way began U.S. thinking on the Cold War, the famous Long Telegram, which was reprinted as the Mr. X article in Foreign Affairs in 1947, that initial Long Telegram was sent on the very day I was born, so I felt kind of coeval, equally kind of aged as the Cold War. I also interviewed the former head of the CIA, Robert Gates, and remember he said to me that he was not convinced, this was 1995, and this goes to Arnie's project as well, that we had fully understood the intelligence dimension of the Cold War. And he said that when he was working for Richard Helms, the former director of CIA, Helms said to him, when you go home at night, don't ask yourself if there is a mole. Ask yourself, who is the mole? And sure enough, after Gates had said this to me, they discovered quite a number of Soviet moles inside the CIA. For money, more than ideology would appear. But the implications of this for particularly, I think, submarine warfare, for missile technology, have not yet been fully recognized in the public domain. If we ask the question, what was the Cold War itself? Was it just a conflict of power? Was it just realpolitik? I think we have to recognize that it was multidimensional. Now, in one sense, all wars are multidimensional. The Second World War involved the rise of nationalism in the Third World. It involved the emergence of resistance in Western Europe. It had huge social effects on all the countries involved, except the Soviet Union, it would appear. But I think the Cold War was more multidimensional even than a world war. It involved traditional conflicts over allies, over territory, over power, over weapons. It had the added new element of the nuclear arms race, which was something quite distinct from traditional arms races, and which came for many people to symbolize the Cold War, the nuclear arms race, all the more so because the weapons were never used, although they were threatened. The United States threatened to use them, well, put them on alert over 20 times, the Russians only once over the Suez Crisis of 1956, and the reason the Russians only did it once was because they were much weaker than the Americans, although everybody pretended otherwise at the time. But it also, I would argue, involved a conflict of ideology. It involved two views of where the world was going, of how society should be organized, of which injustices should be addressed. And in that sense, it was a different kind of, a more complex kind of conflict than that which was associated with, say, the First or the Second World War. Moreover, as Arne has said, and it's very much central to my work, this was not just a confrontation in Europe. This was a confrontation in the Third World, where the most bloody episodes of the Cold War took place. And I would hope that in the longer run, any study of the Cold War would take into account what happened in Vietnam, what happened in Cuba, what happened in Southern Africa, but also address a political issue and a theoretical issue, which is latent in the North-South question, which is the question of autonomy. How far were these movements, these nationalist movements, or these radical or conservative states, really under the control of the great powers with whom they aligned? To what extent was Castro ever controlled by the Russians, or Nasser in Egypt, or Arafat for that matter? We have documents from the Israelis invaded Lebanon in 82. They captured the PLO documents with the minutes of the meetings between Arafat and the Soviets. And what was obvious was the Russians were saying, you've got to recognize Israel, you've got to come off all this Arab nationalist propaganda, you've got to shape up. And the PLO, which was financially and militarily at that time a bit dependent, not very much dependent, a bit dependent on the Soviet Union, took no notice. And on the other side, it's easy to say that Pinochet was just an American client. He wasn't. Pinochet expressed the views of at least 40% of the population of Chile when he took power in 1973, and one doesn't understand him if one forgets that. And many of the conflicts of the Third World, while they may have acquired a Cold War character, were not originated by the Cold War. Right? To take the obvious examples, the India-Pakistan conflict over Kashmir, which began in 1947, nothing to do with the Cold War, but over time, Pakistan became an ally of the West, and India became an ally of the Soviet Union. The Arab-Israeli question is a very striking case. Looking through the telescope now, one would be tempted to say Israel was always a close ally of the United States, but it ain't true. When Israel was created in 1948-49, Stalin supported it. He supported it as a struggle against Arab feudalism, and he sent arms to the Zionists to promote that war. In 1956, when Israel invaded Egypt together with Britain and France, the United States and the Soviet Union together opposed the Israelis and the British and the French. The alliance between Israel and the United States was only consolidated in the mid-1960s, in the time of President Johnson. One forgets that now, looking back through the mists of time. And in the states which I have studied and where I lived, South Yemen being one, Ethiopia being another, Afghanistan, I time and again saw the degree to which communist elites there were not prepared to do what the Russians said. The tail was wagging the dog. One of the most hallucinating conversations I ever had was in Kabul in 1980 with supporters of the more radical faction of the communist regime, the Khalkis. They said, these Russians, they're all cowards, they're not prepared to fight. If they let us off the leash, we would crush the Doshman, as they call them, the enemy, in a week. Now, of course, this was nonsense, but this was the way they were thinking. And yet, at the same time, the influence of the Soviet system of organization, of party, of protocol, of ideology, took hold in these countries. I remember once being in, and of course a very important part of this was having a ruling party. You had to have a ruling party, and so there were about 20 countries in the world which had their ruling parties. I remember once in South Yemen being in a plane, a DC-3, which is an old unpressurized plane flying at about 4,000 feet, and the steward came up to me, and when he discovered I was from Britain, he thought I was a Russian and he wouldn't speak to me, but when he discovered I was from Britain, he agreed to speak to me. And he said, you know, I was in flying school, I passed all my exams, but I wouldn't join the ruling party. So they thought I might take the plane and fly it out of the country. So they didn't give me a pilot's license. He said, but you see the pilot up there? And the door's open. Yeah, he was in flying school with me. He failed all his exams. But he joined the ruling party. And so they gave him a pilot's license. But I'm here to tell the story. So that shows the superiority of socialism over capitalist qualifications. The Cold War was also a context for social history. I think the diplomatic history is important, the military history is important, but social movements, nationalist movements, revolutions, coups, ideas, these things were also very important. There's a need to write the history of the Cold War from below, which I don't think the documents will prejudice in favor of doing, and we have to remember this. If we want to discover why people, 3 million people, gave their lives in Vietnam, you have to look at what was going on in that society and what the values were. And I think non-state actors and non-state movements were extremely important in the Cold War. And I'll give you two contrary examples of this. One is the Cuba Missile Crisis of 1962. This is normally seen in terms of the nuclear rivalry of the United States and the Soviet Union. The United States deployed missiles in Europe, the Thor and the Jupiter, in the late 50s and early 60s, which could hit the Soviet Union. They didn't have intercontinental missile, ballistic missiles of any importance at that time. So the Soviets said, well, they're going to employ them in Europe, we're going to deploy them in Cuba. And Khrushchev, who was a kind of earthy peasant type, said, we will put a hedgehog in Uncle Sam's pants, he said. And he meant by this putting the missiles in Cuba. And the crisis then unfolded, and finally the Soviets were forced to withdraw because they were much weaker than the Americans. But that isn't the only story. Why did the Soviets put the missiles in Cuba, and why did the Cubans ask for them, which they did, and in fact they took the initiative? The reason was that the United States had tried to overthrow the Castro government in the Bay of Pigs, or Playa Giron invasion of April 1961. In other words, it was an attempt to prevent another counter-revolutionary invasion. It was to deter political change as much as to gain a nuclear advantage. And here, of course, we come to the paradoxical outcome. If you look at the Cuba Missile Crisis as conventionally done in terms of nuclear rivalry, then the Soviets lost. They had to withdraw the missiles. But if you look at it politically, which Castro, by the way, never did, then you see a very different answer, which is that the Cubans and the Russians won. Because although, and I stress this, and Arnie will be listening to what I'm saying, or any student of the missile crisis will be listening very carefully to how I formulate this, although there was no formal commitment by the U.S. not to invade Cuba again, in practice, a commitment was made. And this meant that by stationing the missiles, and even then being forced to withdraw them, the security of the Castro regime was assured. And so it was. And that's why he's still there. So on a social or political analysis, rather than nuclear weapons analysis of the Cuban Missile Crisis, you have not only a different account of how it happened, why it happened, but also of the outcome, which is the one that I hold to myself. The other thing I want to say, which I think was a very important part of the Cold War, was that while there was repression in both East and West and violations of human rights, the Cold War also forced positive political change in both East and West. If you want to know why the European Union got going in the late 40s and early 50s and why the Western states built their welfare systems, one of the reasons, I couldn't quantify it, but the major reason was a fear that if they didn't develop their economies and societies and get things going, you'd have a return of the Depression of the 20s, and you'd have the triumph of communism. In other words, it was the fear of Stalin. Stalin, in many ways, is the real father of the European Union, because they were terrified of him, and so they got on with this very successful project, which in the end, I think, had a huge influence on the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe, because it created this maybe very boring but successful politically and economical model in Western Europe, which people wanted to follow. But I think the Cold War was in many ways also good for the United States, and this is something which most American liberals would kill me for saying, and my colleagues in the IPS hated me saying. There was McCarthyism in the early 50s. Could I get some? There was McCarthyism in the early 50s, but in the early 60s, there was the Civil Rights Movement, and the Civil Rights Movement was a claim by Martin Luther King and Jesse Jackson and others, if you guys stand for democracy, what about democracy here? What about the fact that millions of blacks don't have the vote and are discriminated against? And the United States was forced to retreat on the question of civil rights because of the Cuban Revolution, because of the Cold War, because of the fear that they'd be shown up. I'm not saying it's the only factor, but if we draw up a balance sheet of human rights and political rights in the U.S. during the Cold War, on the one side is McCarthyism, but the other side is the enfranchisement of millions of blacks who had not had the vote and not had civil rights up to that time. I know the problem has not been completely resolved, and you only had to look at the voting figures last week. 89% of Afro-Americans voted for Kerry and only 11% for Bush, which tells you its own story. And what about all the others who didn't even vote at all? But the same is true on the Soviet side. The realists in international relations, the Henry Kissingers of this world, write their own history of the Cold War in terms of power and force. But they devote very little attention to the role of ideas, of civil rights, and in particular of the Helsinki Agreement of 1975 in undermining communism. Kissinger's great book on the, as it were, the political and theoretical lessons of the Cold War is called Diplomacy. It's 800 pages long. It even has a nice reference to me in it, actually, which is a bit embarrassing. But if you read it, there is only 1.5 pages on the Helsinki process and masses on salt, nuclear arms negotiations and all the rest of it. Yet it was Helsinki which tied the Soviet leadership into accepting, at least on paper, certain basic human rights and political rights, which set the ball rolling for Solidarity in Poland, for Havel, for all the other things which followed. I'm not saying it was decisive, but it was very important at the level of ideas, at the level of norms, at the level of social movements. And this was a product of the Cold War. Just to finish with on this part of the lecture with a few thoughts on the future agenda, and mention quickly five areas of study of the Cold War which are of minority interest, but which interests me. One is the literature of the Cold War. What about all the novels and plays about nuclear weapons and Third World Wars and all the rest of it? There are lots of books on the literature of the Spanish Civil War, the First World War, but not yet on the Cold War. And yet I think it's a very fascinating area. What about the effect of the Cold War on the environment? If we think of nuclear explosions, if we think of the pollution of large areas of the Soviet Union, if we think of the destruction of parts of Nevada in the U.S., if we think of what went on with the dumping of nuclear waste in the seas, war is the greatest polluter, no doubt about it, going back to the pouring of salt on land in the Bible. And the Cold War was a great polluter. What about the gender dimension of Cold War? I have a wager, going back about 15 years, that there is no process, no component of international relations which does not have a gendered component. And if anybody thinks that gender doesn't have political international effects, just look at the role of gender in the last U.S. elections, the security moms, please. And on the other side, look at the Buttiglione affair in the common market, when the elected democratic leaders of Europe all dithered trying to protect this wretched bigot for days on end, when he should have been chucked out on his ear. There are many gender dimensions of the Cold War. I suspect there is a big PhD to be written on the role of rape in the Cold War, in the wars of the Cold War. The Russians raped their way across Germany. The Americans did not exactly live up to international standards in Vietnam. And as for what happened in Angola with Jonas Savimbi, who I once saw speaking at Chatham House, and a more sinister person I've never seen, the less said here, the better. And finally, can we make any sense, finally, of the space race? Why on earth was all this money spent on sending people into space and to the moon? What possible military significance did it have? What possible ideological significance did it have? It's more and more mysterious to me, and yet it was seen as part of great power competition. One thing about the space race, it did occasion what I think was the greatest gendered joke of the Cold War, which is the woman who said, well, if they can send one man to the moon, why don't they send them all? Which I think was that's 1969. Against that background, let me get to my three dustbins. The Soviet dustbin, first of all. What have we inherited? We've inherited from the Soviet Union, first of all, a bunch of thieving dictatorships. Throughout all of the former 15 republics of the Soviet Union, with the exception of the three Baltic states. Putin is as yet undecided, but one of his advisors was here recently, and I said to her, my Russian isn't very good, but I was talking about Blair and Putin. I said, well, our boy doesn't listen. I said, Nash Malchik na slushait. And she said, Nash Malchik toji na slushait. Our boy doesn't listen either. And what she said about him was, she said, look, he has an authoritarian project, but he doesn't know when to stop, and there are people around him who want to take it much further. And this was before Beslan. But elsewhere, we have a bunch of gangsters, basically. What we have seen is not a transition to democracy. We've transitioned from the nomenclatura of the CPSU, of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, to dynastic nomenclaturas in Kazakhstan, throughout Transcaucasia. We now have Ilam taking over from his father in Azerbaijan, and so forth. And these regimes are well consolidated. They are extremely corrupt. They have lots of friends in the West and lots of banks and elsewhere. And they are there for a good time to come. And in many ways, they are similar to the kind of regimes you have in parts of the Middle East, who have no intention of changing whatsoever. There's a nice story just from Cairo that President Mubarak wanted to help his friend George Bush get reelected. So he called in the Minister of the Interior. He said, go to Washington and help Bush get reelected. So he goes off, and a month later he comes back. And Mubarak says, how was it? And the guy said, well, they always say in the Arab world, Najee. He said, it was successful. Yalla. What was the result? He said, well, John Kerry, 1%. George Bush, 19%. Hosni Mubarak, 80%. And this all. And that is the nature of elections in these countries. And the point I want to make is, forget Fukuyama. I'm a great admirer of Fukuyama in many ways. I don't like people who just slag him. I think he's got a lot to say. But the idea there is a global transition to democracy, there isn't. It's a transition from one kind of thieving elite to another kind of thieving elite. And this is very widespread indeed. And they are well consolidated, and they're not going to give up. Secondly, The second component of the Soviet dustbin is the lack of control of nuclear materials and nuclear weapons following from the breakup of the Soviet Union. We simply don't know where a lot of this stuff has gone. Graham Allison at Harvard has done a very worrying study, but I think well-informed study, of the lack of control, the lack of funding, which is also lack of Western funding, not just of nuclear, but of other chemical and environmentally dangerous materials. And I think we're only at the beginning of this problem. Third component of the Soviet dustbin are the interethnic conflicts which have broken out in large parts of the former Soviet Union. And in Eastern Europe too, in Transnistria, in former Yugoslavia, and let us not forget, in the one communist country in Africa, which also broke up after very terrible bloodshed over many, many years in Ethiopia. The only interethnic conflict that was successfully negotiated into secession was, of course, the Czech and Slovak one in 93, and I think many Slovaks now regret this, but it's too late because the Czechs don't want them back. We changed the locks, is how one of Havel's advisors put it to me once. In fact, he put it much more brutally. He said, we threw their luggage in the street and we changed the locks. He said, that's what we did. But at least it was bloodless. But the prevalence of interethnic conflicts in the Transcaucasus, in Central Asia, is very, very enduring. I remember a famous lecture given here by Ernest Gellner in 1987, before the collapse of the Soviet Union, about the ethnic conflicts in the Soviet Union. And he summarized it as this. He said, in Russia, they hate the Jews. In the Baltic states, they hate the Russians. In the Caucasus, they hate each other. And in Central Asia, they hate whoever the mafia tell them to hate. Now, the level of anti-Jewish racism in Russia has been less than many people had feared so far. And neither Putin nor Yeltsin, to their credit, have indulged in that, and I doubt if they will, and not least because they're good friends of Sharon's. But the spread of ethnic conflicts is worrying and is continuing. The knock-on effects of the Beslan affair in terms of inter-ethnic relations in the North Caucasus are very serious, for example. And in many other places, we see conflicts that are simply not going to be resolved. I was at a conference on the Caucasus recently with a lot of people from Yerevan, from Armenia. And I said, what if the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict isn't solved for 50 years? What if it's like the Cyprus problem, or the Western Sahara problem, or the Palestine question? If it goes on for 50 years, you will be occupying a bit of territory in former Azerbaijan. There will be hundreds of thousands of refugees on both sides. In the end, you are living in an area where you're in the minority. You've got the Turks on one side, the Azeris on the other, with a lot of oil. What does all this mean? And I think we have to be clear that the inheritance of inter-ethnic conflict from the breakup of the Soviet Union and elsewhere is a very long-term and difficult one. What have the Americans inherited? Well, I think, first of all, we have to recognize that this neoconservative administration, which has now been reelected and confirmed, is a product of the Cold War in its mentality and in its personality. They are reliving the strategies, the ideas, and the lies of the Cold War period. One of the things which people like myself and Mary Caldor and others, Michael Clare, Bill Arkin, and others, spent the late 70s and early 80s doing was critiquing the orthodox Republican presentation of the arms race, pointing out that the Soviet armed forces weren't that strong. I remember one of us, not me, saying, you know, if you wanted to work a Soviet tank, you had to be a left-handed midget, and even then you got a 50% chance of getting loaded into the breach and all this kind of thing. And no person in their right mind would swap a Soviet tank or rifle or plane, an American one, for itself, and so forth. But, of course, it made absolutely no difference. The threat inflators, the threat exaggerators, were in business, and Rumsfeld and Volkovitz were classic examples of this. And now we've had a revised version of this with regard to Iraq. I mean, the whole imagination of the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction program, based above all on a lack of knowledge of Iraqi politics, which any expert on that country or any intelligent Iraqi could have told them. It's not about what you can see from satellites, but what's going on in the guy's head. This is a replay of the 1970s. So is the militaristic solution of problems and the refusal to see that the political and cultural dimensions of whether terrorism or the Middle East, which is being reproduced in neoconservative ideology today. It's almost as if they are rerunning it. They are retreads, but in a very, very different world. Secondly, there is a culture of arrogance, of deep arrogance in American foreign policy, as there was in earlier imperial powers. They don't care. They don't listen. They don't listen to Europeans. They don't listen to area experts. They don't believe in studying the history, the languages, anything of other countries. The people put into running Iraq have in large measure been absolute ignoramuses, people with any knowledge of that region. And this has been replicated already in the rhetoric and in the policies of the new administration. And one of the things which professionally worries me most, but I think is irreversible, is the decline of a commitment to area studies in the United States, to understand these countries. Just as you want to understand the United States, you have to go there, you have to live there, you have to study its history, read its newspapers, get a sense of its culture, and not pretend it's just like Europe, in the case of Europeans thinking about America. It's the stupidest thing Europeans do. Think, well, why isn't America like Europe? It's different. And the role of religion is different, and you have to understand this difference. But the same goes for the Middle East or China or anywhere else. And this deep arrogance which is there is, I think, a product of the Cold War. But most importantly is the fact that in the latter part of the Cold War, particularly after the defeat in Vietnam in 1975, the United States, in effect, outsourced its global military policy, not just to third world states, but to armed groups whom they supported against communist states and allies in the third world. This was the so-called Reagan Doctrine. In Nicaragua, the Contra, in Angola, Savimbi, UNITA, and in Afghanistan, the Mujahideen of various kinds, and the largest single covered operation of the United States and the CIA was the $3 or $4 billion, that's the public figure anyway, provided to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And the point about this was that it was a broader attempt to use armed groups on the one hand and Islam on the other as a weapon in the Cold War. Now, as far as Islam is concerned, I think it's important to be careful and to go country by country. But there is a general argument to be made that in the attempt to rival the Soviet Union and to undermine secular, socialist, and nationalist governments in the Third World, many Western allies repeatedly stoked the flames of Islamic fundamentalism. I'm not saying that's the only factor, because there are also social and ideological factors, and the nationalists and secularists play their own role in discrediting themselves. I mean, to take the case of Algeria, one of their top officials said to me a couple of years ago, he said, look, we've been in power 30 years, we've run out of ideas. Now, everybody knows it. He said, the other guys, they haven't got any ideas either, but people don't know that yet. So what he was saying, and I said, what can we do for you? He said, very simple, find me a way of employing 10 million young people. He said, that's the solution. So the socialists and the nationalists discredited themselves, whether on the secularists, whether in the conservative version like the Shah, or in a radical version like the FLN in Algeria, or Nasser in Egypt. But there was a deliberate promotion of Islamism in Turkey, in Pakistan, in Egypt. Saudi Arabia from the 60s had the World Islamic League, which for some reason is a huge office in the center of Brussels, I don't know why, promoting conservative Islam and what's called Wahhabism, though it's not a term they actually use themselves, but also Israel. The origins of Hamas lie not in the creation of a fundamentalist group by the Israeli military, but in the licensing and mild encouraging of the precursors of Hamas against al-Fatah and against the radical Marxist groups in the late 70s, and 1980s in the West Bank and in Gaza. So to repeat, it's not a question of saying they organized it from start to finish, but it is a question of saying that, as in Afghanistan, so in quite a range of countries, the Cold War was the context for the promotion of these groups by the West, with the consequences that we now know. I said there was a third dustbin, and there is. It's the dustbin of the critique of globalization, the dustbin of the world protest movement, the dustbin of Porto Alegre, and the World Social and the Social Forum, and the rest of it. Now, what I'm going to say may be surprising to people, but when communism collapsed in 1991, I think the world protest movement and those opposed to the existing power structures basically went to sleep, and they didn't draw any major conclusions. They said, "Well, this is communism discredited itself. They weren't really Marxist. They gave up, or whatever." And then in the late 90s, it all revived, probably with the big protest movement in Seattle in 1999. But as a result of this long sleep, this kind of left-wing or anti-globalization, Rip Van Winkle, the lessons of the communist period and the lessons of the Cold War have not been learned. First of all, if you are going to propose an alternative order, whether in how to run a university or a hospital or a newspaper or how to run a society, it's got to be realistic. You've got to have your feet on the ground. You can't just dream about ecologically friendly this and interactive that and inter-ethnic friendship and the rest of it. You've got to be tough. You've got to think, how were these things got wrong? After all, communism was a great utopian experiment, and it killed millions of people, and it failed. Communism preached internationalism, yet it also stoked nationalism. And, of course, Stalin defined internationalism as undying loyalty to the Soviet Union. A very simple definition. That was it. And therefore, I think it is right, indeed necessary, politically, morally, even anthropologically necessary to dream, to have hopes, to reject the present. But it has to be done in conjunction with realism. This is a point made very forcefully by one of the great IR theorists, E.H. Carr. He wasn't a realist. He was both a realist and a utopian, but he said you've got to get the two into some kind of sync. Otherwise, you're denouncing the present in the name of something that is A, completely vague, B, very dangerous, and C, has been shown to have failed. I mentioned internationalism. It's very easy to preach internationalism. It's a virtue I hold to myself. But it is something which contains, as does nationalism, its own contradiction. Nationalism is a doctrine which calls for the independence and recognition of individual communities and nations. The contradiction is it simultaneously denies it to other people. We see this in Ireland, we see this in Yugoslavia. We're a nation, they're fascists, or they're settlers, or they're imperialist agents, or they're corrupt, or they're something. But they're not a nation. Look at the Arab Israel, the mutual denial in the Arab-Israeli question. It's pretty obvious the Palestinians are a nation, so are the Israelis. So they both should have their own state. Any sensible person can see this. But no, that's not the way the debate goes. And in the case of internationalism, the same applies. People support other struggles on the basis of universal principles, but then they betray those universal principles in supporting people who are themselves violating international law. If you are an internationalist and universalist, how can you support guerrillas who murder children or who take thousands of people kidnapped like the FARC, or who massacre a third of the population like the Khmer Rouge, or who violate the rules of war, as Hamas most certainly does, as well as Al-Qaeda? In other words, in both nationalism and internationalism, there is this moral contradiction, which I think has to be recognized. My view is support other peoples, but support them in accordance with universal principles, and that means when they violate the rules of war, you don't support them, or you condemn them, and don't come up with bogus apologies for suicide bombing or what the FARC or narco-trafficking or what the Khmer Rouge got up to or whatever else. And this also applies to idols. There was a time, which Arne and I remember well, when Mao Zedong was a hero. Mao Zedong was the greatest mass murderer of the 20th century. He killed more people than Stalin Hitler ever did, including in that you include people who died through political blunders like agricultural reform that led to famine and the rest of it. One of the heroes of the anti-globalization movement, and this is very tough, is Che Guevara. I've been in Cuba 3 times. I've studied the history of Cuba. I've read the biographies of Cuba. I've met people who knew Che Guevara. He was not a nice person. He was a very cruel person. He was extremely cruel in running the courts after the revolution. His ideas about his economy and society were not just abstract. They were extremely dangerous, caused the people a lot of suffering in Cuba, and still do. And his last reckless venture in Bolivia was an idiotic and very, very vindictively conducted campaign, which did nobody any good. And I do not admire him for a minute. And I remember a friend of mine met him in 1963 in the company of two politicians from French Guiana, which is a relatively benign place by the standards of the Third World and of colonialism. And they said to him, "Compañero Che, you know, how should we emancipate French Guiana?" And he went, "Well, I don't regard this as admirable at all. And I think those who admire Guevara and go around wearing his T-shirt should read about him and should read what he did and how destructive his ideas. You ask people in Cuba what they think of Guevara, you don't get a very polite reply, and I won't repeat what they say, except for a few party dogmatists. But above all, I think that the analysis of international relations prevalent in much of the anti-globalization movement is extremely simplistic. At one end, it's conspiracy theory, which is basically, I'm sorry to say this because he used to be a friend of mine, and I've debated with him on more than one occasion what Chomsky is. Chomsky is a great simplifier who explains nothing, absolutely nothing. He makes everybody feel good. They're all victims, but he explains nothing. At the same time, the analysis of globalization as a whole is very often little more than a kind of socioeconomic conspiracy theory. And there is this absolute refusal to engage with the responsibility of third world elites and others in the atrocities being committed in their countries or in the policies where they're being pursued. I'll give you a very simple example. I spent my youth, many people in this room, did demonstrating against nuclear weapons, and people go on demonstrating against nuclear weapons. Well, in May 1998, India and Pakistan exploded nuclear weapons. The Indian High Commission is 2 minutes' walk from here. Not a single LSE student went to protest against it again. Why not? Why not? In my view, the Indian explosion of nuclear weapons in 98 was the most irresponsible act in international relations since the end of the Second World War. Why? Because in the Middle East, everybody, including my friends the Iranians, said, well, the Indians and Pakistanis could do it. Why can't we? And the long-term implications of this are extremely serious. But nobody protested because it was India. Conclusions. Number one, I think we need and should have a historic recuperation of the Cold War, of its causes and of its course, both for academic reasons, because of the importance of this conflict, but also to liberate ourselves from the three dustbins, the multiple misinterpretations and misunderstandings which we've inherited from it. Secondly, I think we have to apply to the Cold War the rigor which we apply to other major historical events, which is that we look at the theoretical questions, not just the historic ones of cause and consequence, but the theoretical issues involved. And also, we must absolutely challenge the idea that there is now one history of the Cold War. John Lewis Gaddis is a great historian, but to write a book called We Now Know is an epistemological monstrosity. Of course we don't now. Do we know, have we one final story of the origins of the First World War, or the Second World War, or the Depression? No, we never will. And we must license, not to be postmodernist, heaven forbid, but we must license multiple interpretations, and we must license social history, gendered history, third world history. And ultimately, I suspect, and I'm very interested to know what Arnie thinks of this, if we're going to look at this North-South issue and the autonomy issue, we're going to have to write histories of each individual country, including the history of each individual Communist Party, because they were far less monolithic than people thought. So we don't now know, but we can now debate, and we have more material on which to do so. Thirdly, I think we have to recognize that the Cold War was not a romantic time. It was a time of terrible crimes on both sides, of dictatorship, of violation of the rules of war, of oppression, of lying on a grand scale, and that both the West, the United States in particular, and the lead and the Soviet Union bear responsibility for what happened and also bear responsibility for the consequences, including on the American side, what Savimbi did in Angola throughout the 1990s. He's now dead, but as Victoria Britton, who works at LSE, will tell you, he killed hundreds of thousands of people in the process, and what Bin Laden and others did in Afghanistan, as well as indeed what the Khmer Rouge did for a time as opponents in Cambodia. How much Western aid they got, we don't know, but a lot of Western aid was given to Thailand, which then helped the Khmer Rouge indirectly. But finally, and most importantly, I think we need to have an approach that is both realistic and utopian. We need to have tough thinking, and we don't have enough tough thinking about the problems of the world today, as if we had a simple answer to the question of migration or North-South economic inequality or the environment. We don't. And there's far too much rambling, Porto Alegre type talk around, which doesn't actually engage either with the history of the 20th century or with the difficulty of the issues involved, just as the neoliberal rhetoric doesn't engage either. And I would like to end by saying, I think for me the virtue that is most important to learn from the Cold War and also from what went before it, which is the period of colonialism, is the virtue of respect. I don't say dialogue, because dialogue has come to mean groups of patriarchs sort of swapping quotes from their holy books and that pressing all the women and the dissident people around them. I'm in favor of our kind of dialogue, but not what dialogue has come to mean in international relations. I'm not in favor of moral relativism. I think there are universal standards. But I think that those in power in the West have listened far too little to the voices of others. And we see this in the anti-terrorism campaign. And I think as a teacher, I would say it, but I also think in politics, if you listen, you then can say, I disagree with you. But if you don't listen, you can't say that. But if you have a dialogue, which is a set-piece exchange of fixed views, you can't criticize either. So listening is very important. And I'd end by invoking the memory of one of my intellectual heroes, who's a sociologist, an American, and indeed a Texan, the greatest Texan of the 20th century, in my view, who is the sociologist C. Wright Mills. He wrote a very important book on the Cold War. He wrote, I think, one of the great seminal texts, which every student at LSE should read, of social science, The Sociological Imagination, which is a beautiful book about how social science can be ethically and historically responsible, but also engage with the real world. And he wrote a book on the Cuban Revolution. The book was called Listen, Yankee. He said, listen, you should listen. Listen to what the Cubans are saying. It doesn't mean you agree with them, but you should listen. And I think we should all listen. We didn't listen in the Cold War. We certainly didn't listen in colonialism. And we see the effects of this now in Abu Ghraib, which people have slightly forgotten about, but was a major scandal. We see it in the way in which a very simplified view of the issue of terrorism is presented. We see it in the declining interest of media and universities alike across the West in the non-developed world, a very serious development. We see it in something that pains me deeply, and I'm an old-fashioned in this, the declining commitment to studying foreign languages by students in the developed world. We see it in the shrinking media concern with the rest of the world, which means that our developed democracies are turning in on themselves. They're turning more and more to simple solutions. They are not having a sensible, tough-minded debate about the environment or about immigration or about security or about terrorism, and falling back on simplification, which is how people get elected in our societies. And all of this is greatly helped by the denial of the lessons of the Cold War, which, as I want to stress, is a very important part of the way the world is as we have it now. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to start the discussion just by following up on one of the things that Fred said in his lecture, and that's the issue of autonomy with regard to the key Cold War conflicts, especially as far as the Third World is concerned. I mean, one of the things that I find really fascinating in terms of the new research on the Cold War, not just by historians, but perhaps even more by IR people, or sociologists, or social anthropologists, for that matter, are the attempts to try to understand the concepts of modernity and how these concepts of modernity linked up to much of what was going on in the Third World during the Cold War. And in that sense, I mean, people like Jim Scott at Yale and others who have written about this, the argument is that many of the projects that were imposed or superimposed on Third World societies whether they came from the so-called right or the so-called left, in fact, had a great deal in common. There were attempts at creating a new kind of state, but not just a new kind of state, also a new kind of society, all together in the name of modernity and in the name of progress. And very often, in some of the Third World countries where I worked during the 1980s, what one ended up with was a constant war on the peasantry. And the attempts of actually dissolving the peasantry in the form in which it had existed up to the taking over of power by either an extreme leftist regime or, in some cases, people who wanted to present themselves as tradition, as in the case of the Shah of Iran and others. Now, I wonder if you'd like to comment a bit on that. I mean, do you see similarities with regard to this, and how do you think we can approach this in terms of the study of the Cold War, if one wants to see it in a slightly more sociological or anthropological direction?
Well, I think it's a very interesting question, and it's one of those questions which forces us, particularly the older among us, to think back, what did people actually think 30 or 40 years ago? And I have to say, what people thought, whether they were capitalist modernizers or socialist modernizers, history was a kind of railway track. We were moving towards something called modernity. We just didn't agree there was socialist modernity or capitalist modernity, but we were moving there. There was a model of the modern. And the question was to shove these people forward, and I'm going to use a word you can't use anymore, politically correct, but it was always used then, backward people. The word backwardness was always used. You never hear this word anymore, except from staunch members of the Indian Communist Party or a few people like that. And the thing was to kind of shove them along this railway track. That was the point about ideology I'm making. There were two different variants of this.
Yeah.
Very interesting, and this is an LSE plug, but it's a true one. The most important economic book in this debate, published in, I think, 1958, The Stages of Growth by Rostow, with the subtitle A Non-Communist Manifesto, was written as a PhD thesis at LSE when he was here studying British economic development in the 19th century. And his conclusion was, and I remember hearing a lecture about this very interestingly, his conclusion was that by studying Britain, which, as Marx said, is the model of the future, Deite, Fabuli, Narrator, and all that, you can see the stages of growth, and basically you've got to push countries along them.
Yeah.
His main conclusion, you've got to laugh if you live in the Arab world, is it's shortage of capital which stops people developing. Well, there's no shortage of capital in the Arab world. In fact, there's too much capital, except it's all in Knightsbridge. It's not in out there, at least only for 5 minutes. It's called recycling, but it's a bit quicker than that. And very interesting, nobody knows how much it is. Is it two trillion? Is it 4 trillion? Nobody knows. And they won't tell you. You ask them, well, that's another matter. And who's getting it? But sorry, I put that on one side. So there was this sense, and what I would argue very strongly is, if you went to third world socialist countries, they believed they were developing their countries. Say, we are backward, we have exactly the peasants, we have to push forward the peasants. Now, of course, did Mao Zedong believe in the peasantry or not? No, he manipulated and murdered them. And yet, in retrospect, the fundamental difference between Russia and China is that the Chinese did not destroy their agrarian society, and the Russians did. And therefore, when capitalism came, the Chinese were able to take off, which has a very interesting further historical and sociological implication, which people wrote about from the 60s onwards, particularly the famous work of Barrington Moore, The Social Origins of Dictatorial Democracy, which is that the key to understanding countries' development is not industrialization or what happens in cities, but is agrarian relations and what goes on in the countryside. And that's a very interesting issue which one can pose now as well. But yes, there was this contempt for the peasants. I mean, I think Lenin once proposed a voting system in which workers had four times the vote of peasants, for example. I mean, he said it straight out. In Afghanistan, and in Ethiopia, and in Yemen, and now in Nepal, you see something very striking, which is those few countries which did not experience colonialism had even more violent revolutions than the ones which did. Why? Because the small educated elite felt angry at being even less developed than the countries which were colonial, and they were determined to wrench their countries into modernity. We don't even have, I remember being in Ethiopia once, we don't even have the hospitals and the roads and the railways that the colonized countries in Africa have, they said to me. And the most extreme case of this was Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, to give you an example, they decided they were gonna emancipate women. Right, 6 o'clock tomorrow morning, it's gonna be women's literacy class in the main square. 6 o'clock tomorrow morning, the party cadres turn up with their loudspeakers, no women. So what they say, right, we're gonna go into the house and start pulling them out. Start putting them out, so the menfolk come and they kill all the communists. Then the army comes and says, we have to punish this counter-revolutionary feudalist village. So they shell the village. Then all the soldiers from that village or in the army mutiny, and the result, which is what happened in Herat in March 1979, is a huge insurrection. They go into a village and they say, we must liquidate the kulaks. For those of you who don't know, kulaks are sort of large peasants of the kind of, slightly more land than anybody else peasants in Russia in the 20s. So they go into an Afghan village and say, we must liquidate the kulaks. Well, there aren't any kulaks. So they'd find some old boy with a beard whose social power rested, and here we get anthropological, on being the person who arbitrates on the division of water and the irrigation system, and settles who gets how much water, how much every day, and settles the disputes. So in return, he gets a few bowls of apricots and nuts or something once a year, but he's then regarded as a kulak, so they kill him. And this is how this modernistic project got out of control. The same in Ethiopia and in other ways. And it's very striking how it's those countries, and Nepal is an example of this now, which didn't have colonialism, where this sense of rage at backwardness and so on, and this pursuit of modernity was the strongest. And then we come to the broader issue, where did they get their models from? Well, they got their models in the conservative cases from the West, from Britain and America, and in the Soviet cases from the Soviet Union. And I mean, you would see in Cuba, I was in Cuba in 68, I was in Ethiopia, Yemen, and other countries, down to the school textbooks, down to the kind of physiotherapy that was taught. It was modeled on the Soviet system, which people there believed was the best in the world. And they knew very little about the West, for example. I remember arguing in 1972 with a member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of Yemen who came to London. He did not believe that there was a state system of providing old age pensions and free medical care to people in the West. He simply didn't believe it. And I had to explain to them that, you know, awful as capitalism was, blah, blah, but actually this is what they did. So, and you're also right to say that the conservative modernizers, and the Shah of Iran is a good example, replicated this arrogance. And therefore, I would say, in regard to the rise of Islamic fundamentalism, and putting the Western and Middle Eastern state role on one side for a moment, it was a rejection of this kind of secular status modernization of left and right, which paved the way for the rise of fundamentalism and the retreat to values and so forth. And it's striking how the modernistic project has been rejected now. We don't talk about this. And the example is nobody talks about backwardness and everybody reveres tradition. You didn't do that. Of course, Atatürk in Turkey was an earlier case. The sad story is that Atatürk gave his two-week speech and got away with it. But the king of Afghanistan, Amanullah, thought he'd copy Atatürk. And he got his family to take off the veil, and he started promoting education. Then he tried the long speech, and after 3 days, the tribes revolted and kicked him out. So that was the beginning of the problems in modern Afghanistan.
Thank you, Fred. I'd much like to go on to discuss that. Let's move from modernity to contemporaneity. Let's see if there are any other questions here. Yes, with the beard at the end of it.
The point you made about Ethiopia is interesting. I was in Eritrea in the 60s, and there was a general view in this country that the Ethiopians were ruling the country effectively. And if you went there, you found the poverty and the oppression. So I think it's extremely important to get areas studies. The other thing is, though, I'm not so sure that the Soviets won the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's true that Kennedy tacitly promised not to invade Cuba. And also, some years later, the Americans removed missiles from Turkey on the Soviet border. But one reason why the Soviets lost in Cuba was, of course, their inferior naval forces. As a result of that, Gorbachev built up the Soviet Navy within 30 years to be not the rival to the US Navy, but certainly an important one. And also Mao Zedong, with his policy of being number two in the communist world, a lean-to-one-side policy, told Khrushchev, you either should have put the missiles there and faced down the Americans, or not to have threatened him in the first place. And it was Suslov in the Soviet Communist Party, with Brezhnev and Kosygin, who accused Khrushchev of, in fact, adventurism and irresponsibility. So you could argue the actual fall of the Soviet Union, the origins, could go back to Cuba in 62, even though the irritant of Castro is still there. And the other thing, of course, I'd like to mention is that you've not said much about the belief in systems. People did believe in communism. They also believe in Bush's type of evangelical Christianity. And that's generally, in fact, not accepted in this country, regarded as being somewhat of a con. Maybe partly so.
Sorry, not said again.
What? As a bit of a con, as an excuse. And I think if you talk to Americans, a lot of Americans support it, sincerely, generally, even though many, of course, oppose it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, to pick up on your last point, I think one of the casualties of the third dustbin is the decline of study and interest in the United States, which, A, is a very interesting country, a very different from Europe. We see this. There have been reports in the press in September, enormous decline in universities and in schools in interest in the U.S. because it's not regarded as the sort of thing you'd tell someone, you know, in a cafe. And the result is enormous ignorance of the United States. I would like to see a serious analysis of how Bush and Rumsfeld took the decision to invade Iraq, because at the end of the day, it looks to be more individualistic and more detached, autonomous from any other social and political context than even the decisions of Saddam Hussein or Nasser or anybody else. I mean, it's a genuine mystery to me. I would like to read a sensible analysis of the role of religion in America, because actually the number of people who are evangelical Christians is declining in the U.S., declining. America's becoming a more secular society, but that's not been translated into, in terms of numbers, but in terms of into politics. In the 60s, they used to teach something called AmCiv. Well, AmCiv was a bit of Jefferson, a bit of jazz, a bit of Norman Mailer. I remember seeing Allen Ginsberg and Larry Ferlinghetti reading their poems in the Roundhouse, and they were great. And people read Norman Mailer, who wrote some terrible books, but also some very good ones. By the way, Mailer wrote the best book on the Cold War called Harlot's Ghost. It's full of a lot of pseudo-British stuff about spies, which is boring. But the overall narrative and command of the issues is one of the great books on the Cold War. It happens to be 1,400 pages long, but it is a great novel, and I commend it to everybody. But within the anti-globalization movement, there's almost complete ignorance of the United States. And here I mention one of my third world heroes, who was the Cuban leader of the 1890s, José Martí. He's somebody I do admire, because he lived in America, he understood it, he understood its strengths, he understood its weaknesses, and he wrote about it very well. But there are very few people who do, and I'm going to annoy some of you by saying this again. I regard the role of the sort of U.S.-based simplifiers, particularly Chomsky, is actually very pernicious in this regard, because they discourage the intelligent and critical discussion of the U.S. And having worked for 10 years for a U.S. research institute and argued endlessly with these people, which I did and do to this day, I regard this as very negative, but I'm saying that. The two other points you raised quickly, I mean, I think the point you made about the Cuban Missile Crisis, it allows of several different interpretations. The point I was making, it wasn't just about nuclear weapons. And even nuclear weapons have important political dimensions, of which the most obvious is the one you just alluded to, which is after Cuba, the Russians said, you will never do this to us again. They developed a long-range air transport system, and I saw it. I was in Aden in 1977 when the Russian airlift to Ethiopia was taking place, and these vast Antonov 22 planes are coming in. They drowned out the whole town. You could see the guys in the airport. They were in civilian clothes, but they were obviously Soviet pilots. And it was Cuba, and it was also the failure to save Lumumba in the Congo in the early 60s that led them to develop a long-range capability. And secondly, to go in for a competitive arms race, which they could never win. And very interestingly, we had an MSc student here a few years ago who wrote a very good MSc essay on the cruise missile. And I said to him, how do you know so much about cruise missiles? He said, well, I used to make them. I made them for 7 years. I worked for Lockheed. And he had done a very close analysis, and to me, persuasive analysis. The Russians were able to copy the West in multiple warheads, in submarine missiles, in missile accuracy. But when it came to the technology of, and I quote him, machine engineering or precision engineering to a thousandth of a millimeter and computers and the rest of it, they knew they could never catch up. And that, but they were trapped in the post-Cuban Missile Crisis belief they had to catch up and keep going. And it was that realization that they couldn't ever catch up and couldn't steal or borrow, which is one of the fundamental reasons they lost confidence. And that's why the military lost confidence. It wasn't the fear of a Western attack through Cruz and Pershing. It was the engineering and technological gap which it exposed. Just to foreshorten a long argument, I think one of the most interesting questions about the collapse of communism, which was not inevitable at the time it happened, was why did these guys lose their nerve as they did? And I think this question of the being trapped in the arms race, more important than the amount of money they spent on it. As for Eritrea, you know, Eritrea today is a Stalinist state. It's part of the Soviet dustbin. Plus, Eritrea and Ethiopia fought a border war, which I am told cost the lives of hundreds of thousands of people after Eritrea became independence. What dreadful irresponsibility is that? But I leave that for others. Here was the most angelic liberation movement in the world, Africa's longest war, a size of a walkie adored by everybody, and yet it's a Stalinist state, as is Ethiopia in a milder way.
with fighting a horrendous war over a few bits of dust. Is this post-communist liberation? I asked myself. But this is part of the dustbin. I mean, I could talk a lot about this, and it pains me to say it.
Reminds me of Brzezinski's comment that the Tantla is buried in the sands of the Ogaden, which must be one of the most important reflections that's ever been made on the mindset of American policymakers, much more than on the Ogaden.
And he also said bye-bye PLO.
He did, indeed.
1982.
A question right at the center here.
Thank you. Professor Halle, you brilliantly described the legacy of the Cold War. Arguably, that legacy is now being carried into a new conflict, a new kind of conflict, which is a conflict even more than the Cold War being conducted inside the landscape of the imagination, if you like. And that is the conflict between the idea that the key issue in foreign policy is national interests, defined in fairly conventional, narrow terms, and that those should dominate over other considerations. I guess you could argue that the citizens of Fallujah at the moment have a ringside seat in watching the consequences of that interpretation of what should drive foreign policy. And against that, the idea that there is an emerging set of interests which, in a sense, transcend narrow foreign policy, the global problems that we face together, climate change, for example, but also the issues arising out of the shared experience of living in a single global information space, a very new kind of conflict. And I just wonder if you have any reflections on how the contents of the three dustbins will affect the course of that conflict, if indeed you share that analysis, and you don't have to
Thank you.
Share it.
As they say in the Arab, alhamdulillah, I mean... This is an example of where I think tough thinking is needed. I am with you. We have global problems. We've always had global problems, and we have even more now. Environment, crime, so forth, proliferation, migration, all these things, energy, many of which can be solved by rational interstate and international cooperation. Two examples, migration and the international energy market. 30 years ago, if the governments of the world had sat down and taken an MSCIR course here and then been sent off into closed room, they could have come up with an international agreement that would have resolved the problem of energy instability, price instability, which is bad for everybody. Because if your price is $55 today, what's it going to be in 2 years' time? You don't know. How can you plan? Similarly, the problem of migration is entirely susceptible. I'm going to use another obscene word from the 1960s and 70s, to planning. We need a bit of planning. And there is the International Migration Organization. They have lots of good ways. And yet nobody addresses, nobody wants to address. Those are two examples. And the environment would be a third one. But I say you have to be tough, because generic appeals to global institutions, humanity, reforming the UN, this stuff is to a penny. This is the land of white elephants. 1995, the 50th anniversary of the UN. Everybody piled in, but it meant absolutely nothing. And I remember one British diplomat said, well, he said, the UN, basically, there are two kinds of institutions, the talking institutions, the doing institutions. Okay, that's a bit of cold water, but not a stupid bit of cold water. And I am for a tough-minded internationalism. This is actually what I'm writing a book about. I got a grant from Leverhulme to write it. But I'm tired of the waffle. And I've heard a lot of waffle, including in this room. It's to a penny. And how are we actually going to do it? How are we going to get national electorates to come up with a sensible migration policy? To come up with are we going to abolish the motor car, which we should do tomorrow morning in every city in the world if we want to save the environment? No. I mean, the chief government scientist has just written a book called The Last Century. He's not Porto Alegrista, he's not a Chomskyan, but he's saying that our generation will be all right, your kids will be all right, the generation after that, not. By the end of the century, it's going to be a catastrophe, and yet we're not doing anything. Three other very specific points about globalization. First of all, I'm struck recently, and I haven't worked it out, but I'm becoming very concerned about it, morally but also intellectually, about the role of violence in globalization. I don't just mean interstate war. I mean police, I mean crime, narco-trafficking, trafficking in people, the whole way illegal immigrants are treated in countries, and the centrality of that violence in the banks, in the financial flows, in the legal systems of every country in the world. Violence is not out there. It is in our society, and it is more and more present, as much as it was in the time of slavery. And we're not moving into, I could develop that.
Secondly, one of the paradoxical consequences of globalization, which I don't think has been adequately addressed, is as people migrate and as the world becomes more insecure and as groups seize power, there's an institution, an old institution, which is becoming more and more powerful. It ain't the state, it ain't the class, it ain't religion, it's the family. And I think that the family is the key institution in the world today. If you look at migrants, they don't send money home to their communities or to their priests or to their states, they send it home to their families. The more insecure people are, the more they rely on the family, just as if you want to rob a country, you set up, you get your sons and daughters, and you take over the place, which is what Nazarbayev and Karimov and all these other tutti-quanti have done. The final point I'd make is you have to be very careful in talking about a global information system, because our old friend the state is much more present than you might think. And the most obvious example is these Arab satellite stations. They're not transnational, they're not liberal, they're not dialogic, they're controlled by states. Al Jazeera, who used to interview me but don't anymore because I told them they were bigger hypocrites than the BBC and they didn't like us at all, so they never interviewed me again, is run by a state with a very clear agenda, which is to stick it to the Saudis and cover up for the fact that they are the aircraft carrier of the United States, which they are, by engaging in anti-imperialist demagogy and allowing the Muslim Brothers to run the show. And it's the Muslim Brothers who now run Jazeera with the agreement of the ruler. It's nothing to do with civil society, it's the state. And all these satellite stations, all the Arab newspapers in London are run by members of states who are playing different games against each other, but basically, and there are red lines, there are things you can't discuss. You can't discuss migrants, you can't discuss the dynastic succession, you can't discuss corruption, you can't discuss the oppression of women, you can't discuss racism, etc. It's all these questions, you just can't discuss any of them on the TV or in the newspapers. So states are much more present. Whether states can control cyberspace and the internet, well, the Chinese and the Iranians are working on it. I suspect there'll be ways around it, but it's an open. They're certainly not given up. So I think it's overstated to say we live in a global information age. And the other example, sitting in hotel rooms occasionally, as I do watching CNN and the World Service, when do you ever see a financial program that addresses corporate corruption or carries out an independent investigation into tax evasion or bribery by major corporations? Never. Never, never. It's all just financial news here, Bobby the Dow Jones here, the Nikkei there, and interviews with sort of patsy propagandists. The independent reporting of business has simply disappeared from the world media, basically, even though you have Enron and all the rest of it. So this is a very superficial and manipulated information context that we live in, and I think we shouldn't overstate it. That's my view.
Have the last question over there, right at the back. Yeah, you, sir.
I would like to talk about the consensus that we see now. Say, for instance, you have American and the Russian astronaut going together to space. And is that the outcome of the post-Cold War era, or something different we are witnessing now? I say that because I'm from Congo, and you mentioned Patrice Lumumba there. In Congo, we have a war since 1998 where almost all the multinationals are involved in looting Congo's mineral resources. French, Belgian, American, Russian, Japanese, Chinese, everybody. Is this everybody looting Congo together? That's another form of consensus. Never mind the 5 million people who have been massacred and nobody's talking about it. Never mind the 40,000 women who have been raped and left there with no medical care. Then let me ask another question about Cuba. I think it is a fact that the education system and the medical care system in Cuba is better than many systems in Western countries, including America itself. Does that say something about Cuba? And then my last question is about the relationship between the U.S. and the EU. We read in newspaper now that when America invaded Iraq, it's to kick out France, which had signed a contract with Saddam Hussein to exploit oil there, and now they kicked out France and many other Western countries or European countries, so much so that Donald Rumsfeld even called France a country, this is a part of the old Europe. So why is this conflict between Europe and America after the Cold War? Thank you.
Thank you. You got in two extra questions that we have to give Fred a little bit of extra time to answer them. That would be lost.
Well, Arne and I are respected from Norway and Ireland, so we're not just old Europe. We're very old Europe and proud of it. And, you know, these French and British are latecomers, but we've been nations, haven't we? I'm getting out of Istik now, but anyway, that's another. Let me address Cuba, first of all. You're absolutely right. And Cuba also has a very developed biotechnology section, which it's using to the benefit of many countries. And it was Robert McNamara, I remember when I interviewed him for the BBC along with the other people, he said, you know, when he was president of the World Bank, he realized that the medical services in Cuba and the educational services in Cuba were better than in Washington, D.C. But the problem, and this is a problem for the historical and moral evaluation of communism, how do you combine that with the recognition that the economic system does not work at all, which it does not, and the latest stuff about the dollar and these chavitos is going to be another disaster, leading to more corruption. It already has. And with the fact that people in the island are fed up. There's a Cuban joke, which was told to me by a leading member of the party. You know, Fidel Castro and George Bush are in two planes and they collide. Who escapes? 11 million Cubans. people in Cuba are fed up. I know quite a lot of Cubans, and after one drink, they talk. And they may well, you often get the argument about Fidel, which you got about Perón in Argentina, I remember you got about Khomeini. The old boy, he doesn't know what's going on, it's the people around who are corrupt, and they make him give these speeches. But bueno, I don't think that's the case. It's true, Castro has lost all the key senior people, his lovers, two or three women he knew who used to talk sense to him, people like Carlos Rafael Rodriguez, there were people who talked sense to him, but they've all gone. They've either died or left the country. So he's surrounded, I have to say, by a lot of young idiots in their 20s who tell him that Cuba's the most wonderful country in the world. And he's enough of a fool to believe them. And Castro's greatest mistake, he has made the mistake which Deng Xiaoping did not make. Deng Xiaoping understood that people want to make money. He read his Adam Smith, if I put it that way. And Castro thinks that making money is bad. He's a Puritan. And it's not for nothing that he had translated and published in mass circulation a biography of Robespierre recently, who was, again, a very austere person of the Castro kind. And I have to say, I think it's a tragedy, but that the Cuban experiment has failed. And I mean, have I time for one socialist anecdote? This is a socialist anecdote that Castro and Boris Yeltsin and Bill Clinton are in a cage with a lion. The lion's going to eat them. And so Clinton says, look, I'm the president of the most powerful country in the world. I've won Milosevic. I'll deal with the lions. He goes up to the lion bites him, and he's bleeding. And then Yeltsin says, look, Tavarishi, I liquidated communism. I stood on the tank outside the White House, fight Yom, so by control of everything under control. He goes up to the lion bites him in the legs. And the video says, compañeros, leave it. He goes up to the lion, and he says something in the lion's ear. And the lion frowns and turns over dead. So Boris Nikolaevich and Bill say, hey, Fidel, what did you do? He says, bueno, compañeros. I said what I always say, socialismo o muerte. Socialism or death. And this is the Cuban, people are fed up. They don't believe it anymore. And you can't believe it. But it goes to the heart of what they called communism was. Communism was a belief in the future. And when they lost that belief in the future, why? This business of the cruise missiles was one example. People began traveling, and in many ways, communism dug its own grave because it educated people. That, in one sentence, is my core view of what happened. It's a social and economic change rather than a nurture one. And Cuba has done the same. But I do not admire Castro. I don't like the pharisaical denunciation of Castro's human rights violations when Messrs. Mubarak, Gaddafi, Ben Ali, and all the others across North Africa are far worse, etc. But that's not to mention Nazarbayev and Karimov and all the new conflicts. You come from the Congo. It's worth recalling your country was the site of the greatest genocide in the history of colonialism at the hands of the Belgians 100 years ago. And it was my compatriot, Roger Casement, who pointed this out in a very famous book. And I have to say that here is an example of where I think respect. Respect includes knowing the history of other countries and recognizing where you did things wrong. It does not mean that you're a prisoner of the past. But how come that the European Union, which is this wonderful project, is housed in the capital of a country which not only committed the greatest massacre in human history, but refuses to recognize it in its own history books, and is itself, in its politics now, based on a kind of apartheid between two different communities. I mean, I'm not saying it shouldn't be in Brussels, but let's have some recognition. And Les Petits Belges don't recognize it. Sorry, they don't actually recognize this in their history books. And it's something that I find very disturbing. But you also pointed out, and this goes to the heart of the point about violence, that companies and states are looting the environment of the Third World. Leave aside the people they're killing, you said 5 million, and mass rape, that too. But the environment of the world has been destroyed through violence by rapacious companies. And I was last week in Naples at an institute, in fact run by one of our PhD students. He hasn't finished his PhD, but he's running the institute, okay, and I told him to get on and finish it. And he told me that on the slopes of Vesuvius, the mafia had been dumping poisonous waste and for years because there's no regulation. So here we have, I mean, you gave the Congolese example, another example of how crime and violence are destroying the environment because of a lack of regulation, a lack of control. And I think this is very worrying indeed. And you mentioned Lumumba. Lumumba was assassinated by people who were working in close collaboration with the CIA. I did meet one of the great leaders of African liberation, Amilcar Cabral, in 1971 in London. Did a long interview with him. He was assassinated 2 years later. We should not forget the director of my own institute, the former Chilean foreign minister, was assassinated with one of my colleagues in Washington in 1976. Pinochet put a bomb in their car. The largest, most important political crime in Washington since the death of Abraham Lincoln. And the violence associated with the Cold War was very, very serious, but has continued in many ways. But it gives me great pleasure to say that the person who authorized that killing, Contreras, the head of DINA, is still in jail. He's in jail for other things. He's in nice jail. He's in the officer's mess of a prison, of an army base somewhere in Chile, but he's still in jail. And I'll say one other thing. The people who put him in jail and the people who put the killers in jail were the FBI, who did their job extremely well, even though we were a bunch of crazy lefties at the time. They did their job, they took this seriously, and full credit to them. They banged the guy, they found the guys and they locked them up, and they did what they should do. The final point you make about space, you know, I don't know why they go to space. It's a mystery to me. I mean, it may be that somebody who knows about technology can say there are benefits, but I think there is a high element of ideology and prestige involved. I mean, it is worth saying, and this is another subplot of the Cold War, that the technological spin-offs of the arms race into civilian life, and Mary Caldwell's written very well about this, are extraordinary. The Teflon frying pan, the pregnancy scan is derived from submarine warfare, basically. The kind of burglar alarm lights which go on are all derived from the Ho Chi Minh Trail trying to kill communists in the 60s. The email was invented for military purposes. So there was a huge spin-off in the West, but very importantly, not in the East. In other words, technological development under communism, where everything was segmented, did not spin over into civilian society, whereas in the West it did. And I mean, this is a very, so maybe there are benefits, but it looks like, to use a terrible word, it has its own autonomy, the space program, but it's certainly using up a lot of money. But it was a good thing when people from different nations and blocs started going to space together. But why they do it is a mystery to me, other than somebody's making money somewhere, I guess.
Which is always a very reasonable explanation when it's something we don't quite understand. Thank you very much, Fred, for a wonderful lecture. And for taking time to answer our questions, maybe we should do the next session with Fred here on technology and the Cold War. It may even include overhead services and AV provisions at LSE. There are two more lectures coming up in this series this term. Next week, on Wednesday, 17th of November, at the same time, same place, 6:30 here in the Old Theater, Professor Richard Nedlebow from Dartmouth College will be speaking on world orders in chaos from the end of the Cold War to the war on terror. So that's Professor Lebow here in the Old Theater next week, next Wednesday, at 6:30, and then Wednesday, 8 December, also at 6:30, also here in the Old Theater, Professor John Eikenberry from Princeton will be speaking on From Containment to Preemption, American Grand Strategies revisited. So stay tuned. A lot of stuff that's still coming up in this series. Thank you all for coming.